The Veritas Radio Network is guaranteed the right to offend, annoy, agitate, shout, heresy, and entertain.
You should start programming right now.
Kind of like the cultural sewage served up on Bravo or CMT, only it's on 24 hours a day, except Sundays. When the truth gets you angry and you throw your smartphone, remember, no one is forcing you to listen to the truth on the Veritas Radio Network.
You can't handle the truth.
You're doing that of your own free will. That's what makes this country great and any gay marriage pointless.
That's offensive.
So there isn't much you can do about it, Chowderhead.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Grab a book, take a vow, and conform your mind to reality. Otherwise, you're just another Judas-inspired Karl Marx wannabe.
And your children will steal your credit card number to buy tickets to the Miley Cyrus Twerker's Ball.
I came in like a wrecking ball.
Are you ready? Let's get it on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
The professor is in. Send your questions for Professor Kevin Gutzman to constitution@veritasradionetwork.com.
And welcome to this edition of the Constitution Hour, featuring Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. This will be episode number 11. Wow, time flies when you're having Constitution fun, right? Remember, if you missed any of the previous 11 episodes, you can always get them on our website at VeritasRadioNetwork.com. And you can download them in complete, beautiful, full bandwidth stereo, commercial free. Just go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com. You can listen to this show live every Thursday at noon Central. That's 1 p.m. Eastern. Please make sure you download our app from the iTunes Store for your Apple iPhone or iPad, from the Google Play Store for your Android phone, or from the Windows Media Store for Windows mobile phones. And we will now go to the Skype hotline and say hello again to our host. I am your co-host, Mike Church, your moderator, and to our real host, Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman, for episode number 12. Kevin, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Very well, Mike. How are you?
I am well. And ready to go. I have to tell you that the reviews are in for the last episode, for episode 11. And we covered so much ground with the subject that that we delved into in such great detail that I think people will be going back to the site of VeritasRadioNetwork.com and will be downloading that episode and using it for actually finding the truth of the matter for many, many months, if not years, into the future. So hopefully we can equal that with what we're about to talk about today. And that is, and this comes up for the fourth time now in our Constitution Hour shows here on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade channel, and that is, once again, the eligibility or ineligibility of Edward Raphael Cruz, otherwise known as Ted Cruz, for the Article II Office of the Executive of the Federal Government, otherwise known as the Presidency of the United States. And as Kevin and I have previously discussed on three separate shows, and I believe one of those shows, we spent an entire show talking about this and fleshing out and laying out the historical case that because Cruz was born of a father who was not an American citizen and was not born on American soil, that as the ratified intent of the Constitution would show at the time in 1788, that he would not have been eligible, he would not be what they would have called a natural-born citizen. No one has refuted our facts, Kevin, especially your deal-breaker, your bombshell that, well, if we went back to the Virginia understanding of, or to the people that that were from the Old Dominion, of their understanding or what English common law they would have been using. They would have been using English common law from the early 1600s, and there would have been no mention of any of the defenses or the excuses that cruisers have made up or have brought to the table for why Cruz is eligible. Now, the latest one, and this actually has been bandied about and talked about for quite some time now, is that the 1790 Congress, which is the oracle of all things constitutional, we're told, proclaimed that any person born anywhere near the continental United States is a natural-born citizen. And Kevin wanted to talk about this and talk about the 1790 Congress and that claim. So, with that, Doctor, the floor is yours.
Well, Mike, you're right. Congress, the first Congress that met in 1789-90, did pass a law about naturalization. And many proponents of the idea that Ted Cruz is a natural-born citizen have pointed to this legislation. They say that although it isn't strictly speaking direct evidence of the original understanding of the Constitution, yet it's highly probative because they say there were a lot of people in the first Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, who had been either framers or ratifiers, or in some cases both, and we therefore should defer to the acts of the first Congress. And I want to talk about this because I think this claim has received a lot of attention, and it's simply mistaken.
Okay.
The thing to notice about the first Congress is that beginning in 1790, the same year as this Naturalization Act was adopted, there was serious division among people who had been framers and ratifiers over constitutional interpretation. In 1790, in response to the pending bank bill forwarded to Congress by Secretary of Treasury Alexander Hamilton, James Madison stood up in the House of Representatives and invented the argument for strict construction of the Constitution. He said there was nothing in the Constitution that entitled Congress to a charter corporation, let alone a bank corporation, that the General Welfare Clause at the beginning of Article 1, Section 8 referred only to Congress's power to tax in exercise of the enumerated powers following the General Welfare Clause. And he said that the necessary and proper clause at the end of the enumeration of congressional powers in Article 1, Section 8 only referred to acts that were actually necessary in exercise of those enumerated powers earlier in Article 1, Section 8, which did not describe a bank. You didn't need a bank, he said, to regulate trade with the Indians or raise an army or coin money and so on. So Madison made this argument. Famously, the Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, later took up the same argument in the bank bill debate in the cabinet. So ultimately, he wrote maybe the most famous explication of this state's rights or strict construction approach to the Constitution, his bank bill memorandum of 1791. What's my point? Well, my point is, which framers and ratifiers are going to rely on? Also in 1790, Congress passed a law assuming responsibility for all the debts the states had incurred during the Revolution on the theories that, number one, these were common efforts, and so they should be funded out of the common treasury, and number two, that it would be easier to manage the federal governments and the United States debt if all the debt were in the same account and the Treasury Secretary were responsible for it than it would be if there were 14 separate accounts, only one of which the Treasury Secretary controlled. The Congress passed this bill, President Washington signed it, and then virtually immediately, Virginia's legislature, led by Henry Lee, who had been a prominent Federalist, yes, Federalist, that is, proponent of ratifying the Constitution in the Virginia Ratification Convention of 1788, joined Patrick Henry in sponsoring a set of legislative resolutions from the Virginia General Assembly. And what Lee and Henry said in their resolutions was that the Assumption Act was unconstitutional. It violated the most basic promise Federalists had made in the Virginia Ratification Convention of 1788, which was that Congress would only have the enumerated powers, and The Virginians did not accept that it was legitimate for Congress to exercise powers that hadn't been enumerated in the Constitution. So the conclusion was, we're going to keep our eye on you. Well, you know, the last time that Patrick Henry had joined in resolutions threatening distant authority and warning he was going to keep an eye on it was in 1765 when he famously sponsored Virginia's Stamp Act resolutions. So what's my point? My point is that what happened was in 1787 at Philadelphia, a large number of nationalists tried to get their fellow Philadelphia Convention delegates to propose a national constitution with essentially unlimited legislative authority to the states, and they were defeated in the Philadelphia Convention. They then went out into the ratification process and told people in South Carolina, in North Carolina, in Virginia, in Pennsylvania, in Massachusetts, in New York, in Delaware, I know for a fact, prominent Federalists like Cushing, Pinckney, Hamilton, Madison told people in those eight states at least that this government will be a government only of the enumerated powers. And in 1790, it was already clear that you had a nationalist majority in the federal Congress that was ignoring this promise, and that President Washington, unfortunately, was signing off on these bills. So when people say, well, we know what the Constitution means in regard to citizenship because we have this statute passed by Congress in 1790, what they're really saying is, effectively, they don't know anything about the first Congress, or maybe they're trying to mislead us, because soon enough, Madison and Jefferson will be organizing a political party, America's first political party, whose organizing claim was that Congress was violating the Constitution by claiming all this power. And soon enough, that party was going to take control of the federal government, and its opponents, the Federalists, would cease to exist as a political party. They were so obviously incorrect about the sense in which the Constitution had been ratified that the party went out of existence after 1801. It ceased to be a viable national party, and soon enough it ceased to exist even in its last redoubt in New England. So I think if people think they're originalists, and the only evidence they can come up with are claims made to power by the first Congress, that is after ratification, not during or before ratification, then they're fooling themselves. Originalism means applying the Constitution in the sense in which it was understood by the ratifiers, not according to the unlimited claims of power made by the first Congress.
It is quite a remarkable chain of events that transpires there in the early Congresses, isn't it? Because there's a couple of things that happened there that history views, or the fairy tale version of American history, is that George Washington goes to New York. Of course, most people probably think he goes to Washington. They don't even know that he resided over the presidency from what's called Federal Hall, which you can still visit today, by the way, right down the street from Francis Tavern, where Washington used to eat dinner. Washington goes to New York to assume the presidency. He immediately begins his kind, benevolent, and totally flawless tenure as the first president. And he is loved by all the people, all the time, anywhere in the states that have then ratified the Constitution. Of course, there's a scene, Kevin, in the HBO miniseries, John Adams, where they portray what happens in the early days of the Washington administration when he sends John Jay to go negotiate a treaty with England, and Jay comes back with the treaty, and the people get wind of it, that it's not very good for the new United States. And there's almost a riot in New York, and they're burning effigies, as I understand it, of George Washington in the street.
Well, John Jay told a friend that if he wanted to, he could have walked from Charleston to Boston by the light of his own burning effigies. So, of course, Jay had a kind of dry, self-deprecating humor, but the point is that there was a lot of opposition to the Jay Treaty, and that was a manifestation of the more general opposition to the Federalist government. The way Jefferson explained what happened in the 1790s was that, unfortunately, Washington was prone to listen to Alexander Hamilton, and Hamilton pushed a lot of measures through the Congress that were contrary to the way that the people had been sold the Constitution. So when finally Washington retired, it became clear to people that John Adams and his friends in Congress intended to abuse their authority, and so in 1800 they voted them out. And as I said before, they never came back into power again. So the point is that the founders generally agreed that the first Congress was highly controversial, and ultimately the people booted those people. So if this is the only read on which a claim that Ted Cruz is eligible for president is resting, it's ultimately going to fall down.
And the claim, of course, the claim also rests on some of the things that we have discussed previously, like that it totally ignores that there would have been any, I believe, what you historians call primogeniture, that his loyalty or his citizenship would have come from his father's side, wouldn't have come from his mother's side, because the first thing a Cruiser is going to argue, well, his mother was an American citizen. And even that claim at the time of little Teddy's birth may be dubious.
Well, you know, assuming, as lawyers say, assuming arguendo that his mother was a citizen at the time of his birth of the United States, there's a piece that appeared in the Harvard Law Review arguing for Ted Cruz's natural-born citizenship. And in Note 6, it cites the Nationality Act of 1730. Well, the Nationality Act of 1730 says that if your father, that is, it's tied to the citizenship of one's father. Well, at the time of one's birth, and of course, at the time of Ted Cruz's birth, his father was a citizen of Cuba. So it's odd that this statute is cited in support of a claim that Ted Cruz is eligible to become president. But the more important point I wanted to make, the more general point, which will outlive the Cruz candidacy, and even if it comes to that, the Cruz presidency, is that, again, originalism means reading the Constitution in the sense in which it was read, it was explained to the people by its proponents, that is, by the Federalists, when it was depending upon them, when it was depending before them for their approval. That's the way Thomas Jefferson explained originalism, which was his approach to the Constitution. I mean, basically, if you think we're going to have a government by the consent of the government has to be the one to which the people consented. The idea that you can have some different approach to constitutionalism than that of asking, well, what did the people think they were ratifying when they ratified it, rests on just a claim that people in office are going to exercise more power than the ratifiers intended for them to exercise. And unfortunately, although Cruz in general claims to be an originalist and in general opposes new assertions of government authority, in practice, in this instance, the arguments that are being raised in his behalf sound like the most sweeping kind of airy assertions of a meaningless constitution whose content morphs from situation to situation that we hear from people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg or that we heard in former times from William Brennan.
It is a continuing controversy. It shouldn't be. It appears to be very clear. It doesn't appear to be any gray area to us, and this makes show number 5 out of 12 now that we have discussed this in various stages of it and looking at it from various angles. And from every angle that has been put forth by the defenders of Ted Cruz, and as Kevin just pointed out, there's not a single one of them that stands up to scrutiny under the historical record as those that ratify the Constitution would have understood. Natural born citizen. And then when I tell people, Kevin, I said, even then, as an originalist, you're still looking at it wrong, even if you throw these complaints up, because there must have been a pretty good reason why that clause, that terminology, natural-born citizen, appears, and it only appears attached to the office of the president. There must have been a reason why they put it in there,
and why there is so little debate over the darn thing, even in the ratification conventions. And, of course, we have that letter, or a letter, that John Jay wrote to George Washington while he was the president of the Federal Convention, citing that there was some foreign intrigue in the Confederation government, and that the convention should take notice of that and should take precautions in writing the qualifications for the selection of the officers of the United States. So there's a very good reason for that clause to be there, is my point, wouldn't you say?
Oh, sure. And in fact, Jay was one of the people who were most concerned about these questions, because during the Revolution, of course, America's first friend was France, and Jay had an aversion to France. His family had been expelled, I think in his great-grandfather's generation, from France for being Protestant. Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes, which was the early 17th century edict of King Henri IV, saying that from that point on in France, you could be Protestant, you could be Catholic. Henri didn't care. But Louis XIV came along and said, no, the Edict of Nantes is no longer valid. If you're a Protestant in France, you have a choice. Either you become a Catholic or you leave France. So the Jays ended up in New Rochelle, New York, among a colony of expelled Protestants from France. And John Jay never forgot that. He often made reference to it. And the chief diplomats who were active among the American congressmen were French diplomats. So Jay looked at this with a skeptical eye and thought it was entirely possible that would continue. And the other thing is, actually, there was contemporary European history behind a fear of attempts of great powers to manipulate the smaller powers' governments as well. In the 18th century, Poland, which of course in those days was right there in the middle of Austria, Prussia, and Russia, Poland had an elected king, and it was the nobles who voted. And famously or infamously, French, Prussians, the Russians, the Austrians, various other people tried to influence the elections of Polish kings. So Jay thought this was a possibility, and one way to ensure that it didn't happen was by requiring that the American president be essentially a native. And that's what natural-born citizen was. I mean, not exactly, but it's effectively it was a way to avoid having there be some foreigner chosen to be president of the United States. The fear there being, of course, that that foreigner would be enthralled to whichever great power had helped to get him elected.
This is the Constitution Hour with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. I am your host and moderator, Mike Church. Remember, if you miss any of the episodes of the Constitution Hour, you can always get them on the download. Please go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com, and you can download all 11 previous episodes, commercial-free, in stereo, at your leisure and discretion, if you are a Founders Pass member, and you can subscribe by the month and by the year. For details, visit VeritasRadioNetwork.com, and go and get caught up on the previous 11 episodes if you're listening to this show for the first time. And I think that you'll be to the better and to the wiser, especially as far as American history and the Constitution goes. We have other subjects and topics to get into here today on the Constitution Hour. And a subject that I did not prep Professor Gutzman for, but I'm going to ask him to prep for a future session. So I'll tease this out here for next week or the week after. And that is, I have not borne witness to anyone actually questioning or even bothering to ask the question, okay, let's say Donald Trump, and today is by the time this show airs, we will have known the results of Michigan, Hawaii, Mississippi, and Idaho's primaries, and if Donald Trump wins Michigan, he will be well on his way to the Republican nomination if everything else goes according to the polls. But no one has bothered to even ask or to, this is what I think is part of our problem these days, where would President Trump find, in what part of the Constitution does the authority exist for the feds to commandeer the land necessary and the access to the land necessary
to construct this famous wall that's going to go from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean on the border of Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and California with Mexico. I haven't heard anyone address it. And as a matter of fact, I haven't even heard anyone ask the question. It's just assumed, I guess, that President Trump would have the powers of King Trump, and you just order the construction crew, you hire an architect, send them down there and start building. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to work. And if we're going to talk about the original Constitution and about originalism and how we should think about these things, perhaps, Kevin, on a future show, we could address that.
Sure, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I think it would be fun, and I think it would it's definitely provocative. So having said that, let's take our first time out, and I'll set up the next episode. There is a controversy going on in the state of Kansas, and that is the headline of our story reads, "Frustrated GOP lawmakers weigh move to impeach top judges." Now, this involves the state of Kansas and some federal judges and some things that are going on there. And we want to talk about this, and we will when we come back. Remember that this show is broadcast every Thursday at noon. Is the debut right here on the Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel. And you can always download all the back episodes. So we will be right back with more of this week's edition of the Constitution Hour here with Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman. Remember, if you miss any of these episodes, you can always download them. Just go to VeritasRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back with the Constitution Hour as it continues here on the Crusade Channel Radio, the way it should be.
If Patrick Henry were still alive, he would listen to the Constitution Hour featuring Professor Kevin Gutzman. Debuting at noon Central here on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.